From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A Turkish university professor is set to appear in court over an exam question about the jailed Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan. Turkish prosecutors have accused Reşat Barış Ünlü of terrorist propaganda. The exam question asked students to compare Öcalan's opinions in two of his different articles. Turkish authorities say the Ankara professor sought to legitimize opinions of the leader of the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party. If indicted, the professor will be behind bars for at least 7 years. Voices of concern have been growing louder over Turkey's crackdown on freedom of speech, including a shutdown of opposition newspapers and the arrest of dozens of journalists who have been deemed critical of President Recep Erdogan's AKP-dominated government. In January, Ankara rounded up academics who signed a petition against the government's military operations in the Kurdish-dominated southeast. Press TV's Nader Fekri filed this report from Istanbul.
This professor at Ankara's, I must stress, this is a prestigious political sciences faculty at Ankara University. And Dr. Reşat Barış Ünlü has been teaching a course entitled Political Life and Institutions in Turkey. As part of the exams that the students had to sit, they had to compare two pieces of writing, sections from two leaflets, one from 1978 and the other from 2012, both penned by imprisoned leader of the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan. The aim of the question was to look at issues such as violence, democracy, and colonialism. The prosecutors have said that the questions aim to legitimize Öcalan's ideas and have amounted to terror propaganda. The dean's office at the university has defended the professor, saying that academics focusing on the subject of Kurdistan violence and independence have used Mr. Öcalan's writings before. People have compared it to using Nelson Mandela's writing at the time of apartheid and after his release in 1990. The Dean's office has written to the prosecutor's office citing academic freedom, but the public prosecutors have demanded 7 years. Now, this comes on top of a petition that had been signed on January the 10th by more than 1,100 academics from 89 universities in Turkey, calling on the government to end the current fighting between security forces and militants of the PKK in the southeast. Several of those have been sacked by their universities, and several have been, quote-unquote, asked to resign. This coming on top of the crackdown on journalists, two of whom are facing lengthy prison sentences, and even the public prosecutors have opened a file on a caller to a television station who questioned, on a talk show, questioned the human cost of the military activities. These are worrying times, not just for academics and journalists, but ordinary members of the public daring to voice any sort of opposition, any sort of questioning even of the government's current proposals. And people are, the US Vice President Joe Biden has waded into this, the European Council has waded into this issue, and the government seems to be moving ahead heedless of any sort of criticism, and by using the label of terrorism or terrorist sympathizers or promoting terrorism, is shutting down any sort of opposition. Earlier on this week, one of the founders of the AKP and former Deputy Prime Minister, Mr. Bülent Arınç, questioned the way the AKP was going. And I said, let me stress, this was one of the three founders, along with former President Abdullah Gül and Mr. Mr. Erdogan, who founded the AKP more than a dozen years ago, he's questioned the direction the party is going, and online messages have called him a traitor. So any sort of, as I said, any sort of opposition, any sort of even daring to question the direction of play that the government has taken is being taken seriously and cracked down by the government, by threats, by the use of the legal authorities to shut down dissent. And it is a very worrying time for freedom of speech at the moment in Turkey.
Representatives of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, or CELAC, wrapped up a two-day mission to Haiti Tuesday with a commitment from the government to find a solution to the current political crisis in that Caribbean nation. The CELAC mission came in the wake of last month's presidential runoff being canceled due to widespread allegations of fraud. CELAC delegates issued a statement saying that, quote, "There is a willingness of both features of the state to find a solution," closed quote. The news came as Haiti's opposition rejected a proposal from the current president, Michel Martelly, to form a temporary government to conduct a rescheduled runoff election. Martelly's term is supposed to expire this coming Sunday, but the political situation in the country remains in limbo since voting was called off last month, and Martelly announced he would not step down unless a successor was chosen. Martelly proposed that Parliament approve a candidate to replace Prime Minister Evans Paul once he resigns, but opposition groups, including runoff candidate Jude Celestine, have asked for an interim government to be formed by a Supreme Court judge. The opposition maintains that elections cannot be rescheduled under Martelly or Paul, who was recommended by Martelly as one potential interim prime minister. Lawyers for the former president of the West African nation of Cote d'Ivoire accused the French government Monday of ousting him by force and installing the current president, Alassane Ouattara, a former deputy director of the International Monetary Fund, at gunpoint after the 2010 election. Lawyers raised the charge at the trial of former President Laurent Gbagbo at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, where he and former political supporter Charles Blé Goudé pled not guilty last week to charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Gbagbo's defense counsel, Emmanuel Altide, addressing the court, said that Ouattara and his enablers, a reference to the French military, had planned to take over the former French colony by force, and said that to arrive at a fair verdict, they must have an understanding of the essential role played by the armed forces under the former president, as well as the roles of the pro-Ouattara mercenary forces and the French army.
Comment alors comprendre le déroulé des événements sur lesquels le procureur vous demande de vous
prononcer. How can we understand the events the prosecution is asking us to judge if the main protagonists are missing?
Comment comprendre la bataille d'Abidjan?
How can we understand the battle of Abidjan without an understanding of the essential role
qui ont joué les forces armées
played by the armed
et les mercenaires
forces,
pro-Ouattara,
the pro-Ouattara mercenary
française.
Forces, and the French army?
Comment pourriez-vous vous prononcer sur la responsabilité des protagonistes
how can you issue a verdict
si aucun élément d'information ne vous est donné?
Of the protagonists without considering this information?
La préméditation est avérée.
The premeditation is clear.
Alassane Ouattara et ses soutiens
Alassane
voulaient
Ouattara
se saisir du pouvoir par la force
intended to take power by force
et la bataille d'Abidjan
and the battle of
est la
Abidjan
mise en application de cette
application of that strategy.
The charges stem from the violence that ensued after the 2010 election, which, according to the country's constitutional court, was won by the former president. When the U.S. and France refused to accept the results, Ouattara's forces and French troops went on an offensive that ended with the French troops removing Gbagbo from the presidential palace at gunpoint. UN sources said that close to 3,000 people died after the violence erupted between government forces on one side and Ouattara's militias and the French on the other. Abiyomi Ezekwe is the publisher of the Pan-African Newswire, an international daily electronic news service that for the past 18 years has been a preeminent source of information about Africa and African people around the world. We spoke with him via Skype Wednesday.
The fact that the president was captured, in actuality kidnapped, illegally detained, illegally deported from his own country to the Netherlands to stand trial in a court system that has already been heavily scrutinized and criticized by the regional African Union continental organization speaks volumes to the character of the court and also to the whole international so-called human rights system. There's been virtually no response by the many human rights organizations in regard to this absolute grotesque violation of due process, of the right to self-determination with respect to Ivory Coast. 5 years ago, during the same period that the Pentagon, the CIA, and NATO and their allies were destroying the North African state of Libya, they were also involved in an operation against Cote d'Ivoire. And this is often not looked at as something that is part and parcel of an overall strategy on the part of the United States and the imperialist countries in general to overthrow and to either prosecute, detain, or liquidate physically, as they did with Muammar Gaddafi, anyone or any group of people who stands in opposition to U.S. and imperialist foreign policy on the continent. In April of 2011, that's when Gbagbo's residence was stormed. It was on April the 11th of 2011, right. And they had started bombing Libya on about March the 19th of 2011.
Right.
But even prior to March the 19th, on February the 17th, is designated as the day of the beginning of the counter-revolution in Libya against the Jemahiriya system,
right.
When they unleashed these militias and rebels, many of whom were even labeled by the United States as being terrorists. Mm-hmm. These are the people that they armed and gave diplomatic cover and later air cover to. And it's clear that the overthrow of the government in Libya in 2011 could never have happened if they had strictly relied on these counter-revolutionary elements, because they were nearly defeated within a period of a month. And they had been driven out of the areas in the eastern part of the country and were being trapped in Benghazi. So they were facing defeat. And of course, the U.S. and France and Britain went to the United Nations Security Council to get a so-called no-fly zone. They got both a arms embargo as well as an economic embargo against Libya, and then a no-fly zone. And unfortunately, you had at least three African governments that voted in support and supported that no-fly zone. They quickly found out that it was just a cover for the blanket bombing of Libya. But unfortunately, with respect to the Ivory Coast, the Economic Community of West African States at that time signed off on what France, backed up by the United States, did against the government of the Popular Front, the Ivorian Popular Front, the FPI, which is the party of President Laurent Gbagbo. So they bear culpability and responsibility in terms of the imperialists, their neocolonial puppets, their governments in Africa, who apparently, at least in 2011, didn't understand the grave implications of what was being done, providing a pseudo-legal cover for this so-called no-fly zone, because we saw the same thing in Iraq beginning in 1991, where it was just a legal rationale for bombing the country anytime they wanted to deny essential medicines, essential supplies, and also to isolate politically the governments of these countries who are targeted through these sanctions and through these no-fly zones.
And they found out that after you have French troops dragging President Gbagbo out of the presidential palace and the toppling of the Jamahiriya in Libya, that the terrorists that took over Libya move into Mali, and so did the French. And the French are now reacquiring their territory, you know, their colonial possessions in Africa.
Yes, we saw their intervention in Mali beginning in 2013. And they had set up the international propaganda mechanisms to make it appear as if this was something that was positive. that it was a good thing for France to be invading their former colony because of these so-called Islamist extremist organizations that had taken over areas of northern and as well as moving into central Mali. But many of these so-called terrorist organizations were either created directly or indirectly and are funded and supported politically by the imperialist countries.
Right.
If we look at the Islamic State and the role of Turkey, the role of Saudi Arabia, the role of the United States in the creation, the funding, and the providing of support for these organizations, it's clear that they are utilized for various reasons to assist in the toppling of anti-imperialist governments in the Middle East and in North Africa, as well as political movements. They are utilized to provide a political rationale and justification for continued U.S. as well as NATO and their allies' presence in these countries or near these countries that have these anti-imperialist governments and movements. So these are two fundamental reasons why they are not seriously out to eliminate the Islamic State or other groups similar to them, because they use these groups for various contradictory and dual purposes. And we see that in Libya today. The IS has moved in to the western coastal region of the country. They've taken over Sirte, which is the former hometown of Muammar Gaddafi. They've taken over other areas. And of course, they're using this as a rationale for coming in and reoccupying Libya on the ground. And that is the plan that they have right now.
You know, also, you had the creation, the chartering of AFRICOM back in the waning days of the Bush administration. I think in September, October of 2008, it was chartered and established in Germany. And interestingly, Gaddafi had kicked out the last U.S. military base, the formal U.S. military base on the continent shortly after the revolution in 1969. But after they took over Libya and Cote d'Ivoire, you have now AFRICOM installed in 35 countries, with either command and control relationship or drone bases or other military apparatus on the continent. You also have all these wars that are going on. Like, what's the game that's being played out, and what's their end game?
Well, their end game is to totally recolonize Africa, the Middle East, and what other areas of the world where they seek to dominate the resources and the geopolitical significance of those areas. And the base that you're referring to is the Wheelis Air Base, which was set up during World War II by the Americans in order to safeguard their interests in North Africa. And as you mentioned, after the September 1st, 1969 revolution by the Revolutionary Command Council, they took measures to close that military base. So they want to, of course, reoccupy Libya. They already have very close ties with the government in Egypt, as well as in Tunisia. And it's quite interesting that in Tunisia, which was the country where the first uprisings occurred in December of 2010, today is working closely with NATO, is working very closely with Saudi Arabia in regard to security concerns and other matters in that country. We know in Egypt, the U.S. government supplies over $1.5 billion every year through the Pentagon, through the Central Intelligence Agency, to bolster the government in Egypt. And we know in Libya, the U.S. has forces on the ground already in a limited fashion, but works very closely with both of the rival regimes. These are the people who were installed in Libya after the counter-revolution of 2011, and now they have split among themselves and have taken up respective camps in both the western and the eastern part of the country. That's why they're trying to force these two groups to come together to form some type of unity government. But as a byproduct of that unity government, they want these two governments to recognize the right of an Italian-led, ostensibly United Nations-sponsored peacekeeping force to come into Libya under the guise of fighting against the Islamic State. Now, Martin Kobler, who is the United Nations special envoy to Libya, is from Germany, and he has a long record of involvement in these areas where imperialism is attempting to dominate. For example, in Iraq, he was involved there on behalf of the imperialists. Also in the Democratic Republic of Congo, he has a history there as well. Now he's involved in Libya and trying to facilitate a military reoccupation of that country. These are the issues that people need to be concerned about. Even the anti-war and anti-imperialist movement inside the United States and in the Western European countries and in the UK should be watching very closely what the Pentagon and what NATO is doing in these various African states.
And then you have what happened in the neighbor of Cote d'Ivoire in Burkina Faso, people's uprising to restore the country's sovereignty and the progressive direction that the country was taking, and attempts by the U.S. and European Union, the colonial powers, to suppress that. And then the situation in Burundi, where the U.S. has been pushing for a U.N. occupation, essentially, and the African Union refused to vote for it because the government of Burundi said that they would treat any such force as an invasion.
The situation in Burkina Faso is also very interesting. There was a national rebellion during late October of 2014 that drove out the 27-year dictator, who in fact had been involved in the coup against Thomas Sankara in 1987. His name was Blaise Compaoré. He took power in October of 1987 after the former leader, Thomas Sankara, you know, who was a revolutionary, a socialist, and a Pan-Africanist, was assassinated along with several of his colleagues and comrades. There was a split within the government over how to proceed, and the role of Ivory Coast at that time, under the leadership of Félix Houphouët-Boigny, who was in power there for 30 years, who was a darling of French colonialism and neocolonialism. The Compaoré had married a relative of Houphouët-Boigny, and apparently switched sides against Sankara, overthrew him, and of course Burkina Faso moved much further to the right and became really a major base for imperialist intrigue in West Africa. And that is still the case today. Now, even with the uprising of October of 2014 and the evoking of the historical and political legacy of Thomas Sankara, the organizations that took over the government, the party that recently took over the government, is someone who worked very closely with Compaoré. They fell out over a year and a half ago over how to proceed. But he has very close ties with the international financial community. And he, of course, has not changed fundamentally the foreign policy of Burkina Faso. It still serves as a base for U.S. and French foreign policy and military affairs in West Africa. There's the Operation Barkhane, which is a partnership that Burkina Faso has with the government in France. So these are very, very important issues. The Operation Barkhane is said to consist of a 3,000-person French force that's permanently headquartered in N'Djamena, which is the capital of Chad. The operation has representation from five countries in West Africa and Central Africa. That includes Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, as well as Niger. And these countries are described as the G5 Sahel countries. So they're involved in constant military operations with France, as well as the United States.
With Africa, I'm so firmly entrenched now across the continent. Is the African Union capable of any independent agency in trying to deal with these problems?
Well, that's a very good question. That remains to be seen. On some issues, they do take positions at variance with the imperialist states. For example, a proposal put forward by Uhuru Kenyatta at the recent African Union summit to withdraw from the Rome Statute that governs the International Criminal Court is progressive. In 2013, during the 50th anniversary of the African Union, there was much discussion about the bias and even racist character of the International Criminal Court, even though they do have a woman who's from Gambia who's the chief prosecutor now. But at the same time, the majority of the court obviously is still dominated by Europeans. And what's interesting about the ICC in relationship to the African Union member states is that the United States itself and other European states say they are not bound by the jurisdiction or the authority of the ICC, yet they utilize the ICC as a mechanism for fostering their foreign policy in Africa.
Yeah, it's a cute trick. The U.S. isn't the signatory to the Rome Treaty.
No. And as I said over TVC, Nigerian television, last week, that Africans are no longer colonial subjects. Africans are no longer slaves. Why should the Netherlands be trying an African leader when they have never paid reparations, they have never been held accountable for their involvement in the Atlantic slave trade? Just go look up the Dutch West India Company just to get an example of the type of destruction that they carried out in several West African regions during the 17th century. They were one of the earlier participants in the Atlantic slave trade and colonialism. They were upstaged by the British and the French, but they were involved as well. And they still have colonies today in the Caribbean, Bonaire and others, Curaçao. These places are still colonies of the Netherlands. So they have to come to grips with their own history. Italy, for example, the Rome Statute, they had colonies in Africa. They occupied Libya. They wiped out anywhere between one-third and one-half of the Libyan population during the early decades of the 20th century when they were attempting to colonize them. These are issues that have to be addressed by the African Union in response to the International Criminal Court. They attempted to prosecute Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, who, by the way, was not favored by the United States in 2013 when he ran for the presidency. In fact, they were threatened by both Washington and London that there would be repercussions if the Kenyan people elected Uhuru Kenyatta. And that collapsed last year, the attempt by the ICC to prosecute him for violence in the aftermath of the 2007 elections. Also, William Ruto, who is the vice president of Kenya, they still have not resolved the efforts by the ICC to prosecute him. And all of the countries that have been targeted by the International Criminal Court have been African except for Georgia, which was a part of the former Soviet Union. So clearly, this court is biased. They've never investigated any of the crimes committed by the United States government, successive administrations, or the British government, or the French government. They have not looked into the destruction of Iraq based on false premises, the destruction of Syria in order to overthrow a legitimate internationally recognized government, the crimes committed in Yemen, where they've backed for nearly a year now, daily bombing operations, utilizing U.S. planes, U.S. intelligence sharing, refueling technology against Yemen by the Saudi Gulf Cooperation Council, or developments in Lebanon or in Palestine, or in Libya, for that matter. These people have never investigated or questioned, let alone indicted and kidnapped and brought to The Hague, George Bush, Barack Obama, David Cameron, Tony Blair, Nicolas Sarkozy, Francois Hollande, any of these people have been brought, even questioned, before the International Criminal Court.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.